Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And now, here is your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. I'm your host, John Johnston. My throat hurts, so I apologize in advance for anything I mess up. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, stuff.
And things.
Other free stuff.
There's some free stuff.
There is free stuff. At Ballistic Radio. Wait, hold on. I already did the ballisticradio.com. Look at this. Cold medicine is messing with me. Facebook.com/ballisticradio. Coasting with me, the man who will soon be taking over and reading all the ads, Jack.
Yay!
You're like, no.
Sounds like a horrible idea.
Not all the ads. Oh, reading all the ads is fine. Typing all the ads. Sorry. Anyway. We got a good show tonight. We're going to have Andrew Branca on from the Law of Self-Defense. But hey, first, guess what, Jack?
What's that?
This segment brought to you by Tactical Night Vision Company. The night is dark and full of terrors. Or at least, it used to be. But now we have the technology to fight the night. And TNVC is your one-stop shop for all your dark fighting needs. From the TNV PVS-14 night vision goggle to the IR Patrol thermal monocular and everything in between, TNVC can outfit your defense against the dark arts. Doesn't matter if it's your lost keys, the enemy, or that little kid from down the street that likes to wander off. Stay in your yard, kid. Off mine. TNVC has what you need to find things in the dark. TNVC, own the night. What?
Just so many...
Get off my lawn.
They're so prevalent right now.
I'm sorry. Let's not go there. Let's get Andrew Branca on, because no one wants to listen to me make lame jokes for the entire show. Joining us, Andrew Branca. Andrew, how's it going, man?
Very good, John. How are you doing?
Oh, not too bad. I apologize in advance for any disjointedness or anything like that. I've been taking cold medicine.
So. I've heard your show before. I anticipated.
Perfect. Oh, nice. Good. So for those that don't know, you might go on over your background a little bit, tell us about what you do, and we'll just go from there.
Sure. I'm an attorney. I specialize in use of force law, meaning self-defense, defense of others, defense of property. I specialized in that area since 1998, so doing it, good God, longer than I'd like to think about at the moment. We try to teach our clients, and some of our clients are people who've just had to use force and are facing criminal liability, and others are people who anticipate they might have to use force someday in defense of themselves, their family, or their property, and want to be prepared to win not just the physical fight, which is, of course, the most important thing. If you don't win that, everything else becomes less pressing, but also not win the physical fight merely so they can spend much of the rest of their life in jail, but also win the legal fight that follows. Our tagline is carry a gun so you're hard to kill, know the law so you're hard to convict.
Well, there you go. Man, you should get like a patch made or something like that. You know, with
We have challenge coins, the whole thing, yeah.
Well, there you go. Now, I guess I got a couple different directions I want to go with this, but some of the things that I'd like to get out of the way first, then we'll delve into this, is some of the common areas where I get asked a lot of questions about the law. I'm sure you get asked these sorts of things too, but before we get to those, is there anything in particular that surprises you that people don't know or that people still ask you that seems obvious but isn't?
Oh, yeah, there's an infinite number of ways people mess up their self-defense claims, just about every way imaginable. I give, as you know, we do, in addition to our book, we do seminars all over the country, and I, of course, take questions from the audience at those seminars all the time about various self-defense scenarios. And about half of them I can answer with the simple statement, well, just don't do that. people get themselves into trouble all the time for doing things that simply don't need to be done, getting engaged in conflicts they don't need to be engaged in. doing silly things like one story in the news right now is a police officer who had the profanity on the dust cover of the AR he was using. I mean, there's just no reason for that. That doesn't help you win the physical fight. It doesn't help you win the legal fight. So don't do stupid stuff.
So would you say that, well, here, let's talk about, you know, modifying guns first or things like that. Would you say that if it's not something you can articulate why it helps you or makes you safer or something like that, that you just shouldn't do it?
I mean, I put modifications into different categories. There's a lot of modifications I don't worry about at all, and there's others about which I have great concern. And the ones that I have concern about are the ones that influence or change the manner in which the gun will fire.
Okay.
And I'm particularly talking about things like safeties or modifications that make the trigger lighter, so easier to discharge, or take less pressure to discharge. Those kinds of things, I would absolutely urge people simply don't do it on any gun they're using for serious purposes. Now, you have a race gun, you shoot USPSA or something like that. I don't care what you do with the gun. Do whatever you want. But if it's intended for serious social purposes, for self-defense, defense of your family, you don't want to modify how or when the gun fires. When it comes to trigger weights, first of all, you open up a real risk that under pressure you will discharge the gun when you didn't intend to because mm-hmm. the trigger is so much lighter. Or you open up the door to the prosecutor to argue that's what's happened, that in fact your shooting of that other guy was not a deliberate act of self-defense but was an accidental discharge. And if he can convince the jury it was an accidental discharge, self-defense does not apply. It's not a legal defense to an accident. And then you're looking at a criminally negligent homicide with no real adequate legal defense against that charge. With safeties, the issue is, you know, sometimes people get a 1911 and they don't have proper technique. They don't depress the grip safety enough to fire the gun, and they get frustrated and they pin the grip safety down, that kind of thing.
Okay.
For God's sakes, don't do that, because you'll never convince a jury that all the engineers and all the experts who designed that firearm and believe that safety was necessary to its proper function knew less than you know, and therefore it was appropriate for you to disable that safety.
What?
Any other kind of modification, sights, non-issue, color of the gun, non-issue, stippling, that kind of thing, really a non-issue, because none of that affects how the gun actually fires. But as we said about with the cop with the dust cover, just don't do stupid stuff. Don't put thug killer or something on the slide. That just really damages your self-defense narrative in front of the jury.
Well, okay. We got about 30 seconds left in this segment. I want to touch on this a little bit more when we get back, just because I thought of at least two separate questions to that. Would you... It's that awkward time before the commercial break where I just fill space.
I can fill it a little for a few seconds if that's all you have left. I usually advocate to people, if you're worried about the trigger weight of your gun or how the trigger feels or things along those lines, you're picky about it, go to the store, feel a lot of guns, try the triggers out, find one with the trigger you like as it exists from the factory. Buy that gun. That's your self-defense gun. Don't make any modifications to the trigger.
Well, there you go. Hey, we got to go to break. Right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, country's leading manufacturer of air rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Sig Sauer, now with more options. We're not all the same, and our carry gun shouldn't have to be either. Sig Sauer gives you choices. With more models than the Bible's got Psalms, it's never been easier to find a Sig Sauer that fits your needs. From the extremely versatile striker-fired P320 with modular grip frame to the Legion Series P226, the single-stack P225A1, or the entry-level SP2022, Sig Sauer makes a model that's right for you. Just don't ask for Callahan full-bore auto-lock. They don't make that yet. Sig Sauer, when it counts. And also, your premier source for SIG parts and accessories, TopGunSupply.com. TopGunSupply.com is your web source for fine firearms, parts, and accessories. True product specialists committed to delivering the highest level of customer support to you. They carry top name brands including Ed Brown, Wilson Combat, Les Bears, Sig Sauer, and many more, as well as premium AR pattern rifles like Daniel Defense. Whether you are looking to protect yourself, are a first-time gun buyer, or inverted, or maybe you're a competitive shooter, TopGunSupply.com can satisfy your firearms needs. TopGunSupply.com. You did like the little, because I was inverted.
Yeah.
Hand sign.
Because you were inverted.
Oh.
You can't see it on the radio, but he was actually upside down when
I read that ad.
Yeah, the whole time.
It was
impressive.
Jesus. Most impressive. And Andrew Branca. Andrew.
Hey, John.
Now, we were talking about modifying guns and, you know, whether or not you should do certain things. You were saying don't change how the gun fires. Now, to be fair, if you do that sort of thing, you're not saying that you're going to be convicted because you've done that, but it will be something you have to explain, right?
People need to think of the prospect of getting convicted. Generally, it's not a black and white affair. You're somewhere along a continuum. You could do everything right, legally speaking. You're still not going to be facing zero risk that you could be convicted. Something could always go wrong. You could get a crazy jury. You could end up with a bad criminal defense attorney. Key witnesses could not show up. So there's never non-zero risk. There could potentially be 100% risk of conviction if you do things really wrong.
Right.
But usually where people find themselves is somewhere on that continuum between something more than zero and 100%. And what you don't want to do, what I try to discourage people from doing, is doing things that move them towards the 100% end of the spectrum. You want to move yourself as far to the zero end of the spectrum of the continuum as you possibly can. So it's not so much that if you and a lot of it is order of degree. So you have a Glock, comes from the factory with a 5.5-pound trigger. You polish parts and things, and you get it down to a nice 5-pound trigger. Really a non-issue in my mind. But, of course, there's competitive trigger kits, units you can drop into a Glock to get the trigger down to, say, 3.5 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
That would give me great concern. I feel like you're really moving yourself closer to the 100% point of that conviction continuum and not doing what you want to do, which is moving yourself closer to the 0%.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. And, well, I guess the other thing, too, is that if you have to pay an expert witness to come explain why you did something, that costs even more than it was going to begin with, and it's already a pretty spendy affair, isn't it?
Well, of course, a good expert witness costs a lot of money. And believe me, if you're brought to trial, you will spend as much money as you have to spend on that case. There's a huge difference between a $30,000 legal defense and a $300,000 legal defense. But you have to keep in mind that we can't always assume that an expert witness is going to be permitted. Expert witnesses are generally permitted when the issue is something the judge agrees it would be difficult for a non-expert juror to understand what's being discussed.
Okay.
A judge might very well say, well, trigger weight, that's how much pressure you need to have the trigger discharge the gun. Oh, I'm not sure that's too complicated for a juror to understand that you need an expert witness to come and testify. There are more complicated things like the Tooler drill, for example, where clearly a juror knows nothing about that. It's a little more complicated. We're talking about reaction times, blah, blah, blah. It's a standard for law enforcement, all that kind of thing. That's a lot easier to convince a judge you need an expert witness on. But you can't assume you can bring an expert witness in just for anything.
Okay. Let's sort of backtrack a little bit. One of the things you were talking about is not involving yourself unnecessarily. Can you discuss that a little bit more and what exactly you mean, and just, I guess, how being the aggressor and not being the aggressor matters for this?
Sure. Well, first of all, people have to keep in mind, it's really important to understand that the people who are judging your conduct, your claim of self-defense, none of them were there at the time you acted in self-defense. Not the police, not the prosecutors, not the judge, not the jury. All they're basing their decisions on are these narratives or stories that they're hearing in the courtroom, a narrative of guilt from the prosecutor, a narrative of innocence from your criminal defense attorney. They have no idea, the jury does, has no idea whether or not you are actually the aggressor in the situation. And strictly speaking, from a legal perspective, that's not what really matters in terms of the outcome. It matters less whether or not you are the actual aggressor than if you can be made to look as if you were the aggressor.
Okay.
And people engage in conduct all the time that a prosecutor can make look like aggressive conduct. For example, many people feel if they live in a stand-your-ground state in 34 states, the large majority of states are stand-your-ground states, they don't have a legal duty to retreat from a confrontation before they can defend themselves. And that's true as far as it goes. But one way people get in trouble is they have a safe avenue of retreat, they choose not to take advantage of it, and the prosecution attacks their self-defense claim not on the issue of retreat, because stand your ground gets in the way there, but to characterize them as a mutual combatant. A mutual combatant is traditionally when two guys say, all right, let's go outside the bar and settle this like men, right? They agree to have a fight with each other.
Right.
If you're a mutual combatant, you cannot be acting in self-defense. You're both aggressors in the conflict. Well, if you're facing some challenge and you have the opportunity to avoid having to fight and instead you stay and fight, that looks a lot like mutual combat. So that's an example of where even in stand your ground states, your failure to take advantage of a safe avenue of retreat can still be used to kill your claim of self-defense, not on the issue of retreat, but on the issue of whether or not you were a mutual aggressor in the conflict.
So is that something where if we find ourselves in a situation, we need to be able to explain why we didn't do something or why we did do something?
Now, the strongest position you can be in is to have a well-articulated, evidence-based, not speculation-based. People get in trouble in that a lot, too. An evidence-based, articulable reason why you had no other alternative but to use force in that scenario. When I say speculation, where people get in trouble is, and you hear this all the time when you hear two guys talk to each other about, oh, what they would do in various self-defense situations. Invariably, they get to a point where one of them says, well, for all I know, he could have had a knife or he could have had a gun.
Right.
That's not evidence. That's speculation. That's imagination. And that literally has no place in the courtroom. You can't just fabricate things like that. The only things allowed in court are things that are supported by some evidentiary basis. And the fact that someone hypothetically could have had a gun or a knife is not going to be enough for a legal argument.
So is that something where if you've you know, gone to the right classes or been examining these sorts of issues for long enough and you start talking about like, well, they were exhibiting all the common grooming cues before an assault takes place. They were, you know, checking their waistline repeatedly like they had an object stored there, and based off of X, Y, and Z that I've done in the past, I came to the conclusion that they were probably armed. Is that, you know, sort of what we're talking about?
Or yeah, that's sort of what we're talking about. Now, that would make I would use that kind of perception, and that's all evidence. Your perceptions of actual conduct is evidence that's useful in court as, for example, the basis for why you had a reasonable fear of harm, all these kind of pre-attack indicators.
Right.
I'm not sure you can assume from that they have a weapon.
No.
But what those pre-attack indicators can do is suggest that they're a threat, and then if there's other conduct that's consistent with having a weapon, like they're messing around with with their shirt, like they might have a gun under there, or they're reaching into their pockets, things along those lines. The combination of the overt physical act and these other pre-attack indicators could be a reasonable basis for believing that they're preparing to deploy a weapon.
Okay. So let me sort of circle around then. Would you say that one of the things that training does for us, whether it's training on the law or training force-on-force stuff or whatever, is gives us a position that is more easy to articulate from?
Absolutely. And I wish people did this in a more rigorous way, frankly. We just started this year in our seminars, and our seminars are traditionally 6 or 7 hours of classroom lecture. Right. I mean, it's very much like a law school seminar. But we just started adding as an option a laser simulator component where people can stay after class, engage in laser simulations against attackers using a CERT pistol. They have to solve the self-defense problem, the physical problem. And then they turn their back to the screen and they have to explain to the class, they have to articulate what they did, what they saw, and what was the legal basis for their use of force. And it's amazingly difficult for people to do this, even under the very modest simulated stress of a simulator.
Right.
Now, of course, and these are people who've just sat through 6 or 7 hours of lecture on what the law is, and they still have trouble doing it. So I would really like, and I'm not an expert on things like pre-attack indicators. That's not my area of expertise, but I would really love it if there were courses that kind of combine the legal aspects, the need, and the kind of story, narrative you need to be able to articulate, and then provided a more robust foundation of those tools, the skills you would use to both identify in the actual encounter, self-defense encounter, what the threats are, and have the skills needed to be able to articulate all of that after the fact. That articulation is your self-defense claim.
Okay. So as far as that all goes then, what do you think, you know, let's say someone has not gotten to a class yet and they, you know, they've not come to one of your seminars or gone and taken like a, you know, an ECQC type class with Craig Douglas or one of those guys. What's something that they could think about right now, listening to this before they go and do those things, that might help them out if they find themselves in a situation?
Well, the single biggest thing that people can do to help themselves is simple avoidance, is getting out of situations at the very earliest stages when they begin to look like they're going sideways.
Mm-hmm.
There's been many times I've been out with my wife, and I carry a gun every day, even living in Massachusetts. I've had a concealed carry permit my whole adult life. We're at a movie theater. We're at the dinner. Things look like they might be going a little sideways. We simply leave. We walk out.
Right.
Because we don't want to be there if something escalates into a real fight. Too many people get engaged either because they're not aware of their environment or they're not thinking about where the environment is headed. Everyone learns this phrase, situational awareness, but they tend to practice it in a rather static way. Like, they're locked in position and they have a radar going on around them.
Yep.
But of course, real life is much more fluid than that. You're moving. The people in your environment are moving. Things are changing. And you have to be able to, like playing chess, you have to be able to look several moves ahead. How does this environment look like it's developing into? And be prepared to take appropriate measures not to be there. The best way to win a fight for people like us is simply to be someplace else.
Well, and do you think that people, and we got about 30 seconds left, but do you think that people, since they view themselves as the good guys, assume that everyone else will also?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said earlier, they one of the most shocking experiences our clients have is when we have to explain to them that their conduct, when filtered through a prosecutor's narrative of guilt, is going to look a lot like a bad actor, not like a good actor. And that's what the jury is going to see, because the jury, of course, does not know them.
Right. All right. We got to go to break right now. You are listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Blue Force Gear. Doesn't matter if you're fast roping out of a Blackhawk, serving high-risk warrants, or trying to figure out which aisle they hide the kale in. I wish I didn't have to eat that stuff. Blue Force Gear has a solution for you. Do you need a low-visibility concealed carry option? Check out their belt-mounted multi-use pouch that utilizes 10-speed technology to hold magazines, lights, and other tools close to your body while moving with you. Maybe you need a lightweight minimalist plate carry to throw on over top of your duty gear. If so, take a look at the Blue Force Gear's Plate Minus. Maybe you just need a better way to sling your rifle. They've got you covered with the Vickers sling. If you need to carry gear, they make a way for you to do it. Blue Force Gear, always better. And also, Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat makes you the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. So, we are talking with Andrew Branca from the Law of Self-Defense. Andrew, so, but before the break, I'm sorry, I kind of felt like I interrupted you there, but I sort of want to fast forward a little bit and talk about actual, you know, we've gotten to the point where we're using force. There's a couple things that I run into, and I don't know if you run into it or not, is that people assume that they need to get injured before they can utilize force. And also, too, they assume that if they have a less lethal option but then go to a lethal without having tried utilizing the less lethal option, they might get in trouble. Can we sort of talk about all that for a little bit?
Sure. You touch upon two of the five elements of any self-defense claim. This is true in every state in the country. The five elements are innocence, imminence, proportionality, avoidance, and reasonableness. The two you just touched upon was imminence and proportionality. So imminence, does someone have to wait to get hurt before they can act in self-defense? This actually came up in some respects in the George Zimmerman trial, where he was tried for murder for having shot Trayvon Martin. It turned out that George Zimmerman's actual injuries that he suffered were not that severe. He had some abrasions on the back of his head. His nose was messed up for about a day or so. And yet he was still found legally justified in using deadly force against Trayvon Martin. And people wondered, well, how could he possibly have been justified in shooting and killing someone if he only had a few scratches on the back of his head? The reason is you're allowed to defend yourself, not against the injuries you've already suffered or are actually in the process of suffering, but against the injury you're reasonably about to suffer, the imminent injury that's about to happen. In George's case, he was having his head slammed against the sidewalk, so he was defending himself not against the blows that had already happened, but the blow that was about to happen next that could have caused him death or grave bodily injury.
Okay.
In terms of proportionality, unfortunately, people get in a lot of trouble on this issue. Now, the matter that you addressed specifically, that people might be carrying a non-deadly means of self-defense and feel that they're obliged, legally obliged, to try to employ that less lethal force before they can go to their gun, for example, that's simply not true. Your defensive force has to be proportional to the threat. If you're facing only a non-deadly force threat, you're supposed to be using only non-deadly force in self-defense. But if you're immediately faced with a deadly force threat, someone threatens you with a knife, for example, there's no requirement that you first move step by step up some use of force continuum and try to deploy non-deadly force first. You're allowed to respond to a deadly force threat immediately with deadly force. Where people get in trouble, unfortunately, is when they go out and they get a concealed carry permit, they slap on that gun, they feel very empowered. I remember what it felt like when I got my first concealed carry permit. And they feel like now that they have a gun, they're all set. But the fact is, if you look at the FBI statistics, you're five times more likely to be facing a non-deadly threat than you are a deadly force threat. And you can't use the gun against a non-deadly force threat. And unless they've equipped themselves with some non-deadly means of self-defense, they often panic and go to the gun in circumstances where they're not legally entitled to go to the gun. And now they're facing charges of aggravated assault, typically good for 10 or 15 years in prison, and they don't have a very good legal defense.
So do you think it's... I mean, I see a couple of issues there, but it seems like what that is somebody panicking and utilizing the only tool they've prepared themselves to use, which is the gun.
Exactly.
So as far as, and the reason why I brought up, you know, spray, is I'm a big fan of having a OC spray with me. I hear a lot of people say things like, well, I won't carry that because if I didn't use it and I had to shoot someone, then I'm going to get prosecuted on that. So.
What you need to be able to do is, if you've shot someone, is you need to be able to articulate a reasonable perception of a deadly force threat against you. If you can do that, it's completely irrelevant whether or not you had OC spray or not. It was a deadly force fight. You responded in self-defense with deadly force. That's going to be your narrative. I mean, pepper spray won't even be on the table. Now, if you can't articulate a reasonable perception of a deadly force threat, if it only looks like a non-deadly force threat, say, for example, you speculated that your attacker could have had a knife or could have had a gun, but there was no evidence on which you could articulate why that was a reasonable perception, well, then you could be in trouble for having used deadly force, for sure, because it looks like you were not, in fact, facing a deadly force threat.
Right. Now, you brought up the five elements. We talked about two of them. Do you want to go over the other three real quick since they came up?
Sure. Well, we've kind of talked about innocence already a little bit in terms of mutual combat.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the innocence element is intended to prevent someone who's actually an aggressor or a criminal from trying to be able to justify their use of force against someone as self-defense. Where people like us get in trouble is not that we're the aggressors. Of course, we're the good guys. But when we engage in conduct that can be made to look as if we were the aggressor.
Right.
One example we already talked about was mutual combat. If it could be made to look like you had the option not to fight and you chose instead to stand and fight, that looks a lot like mutual combat. Because the agreement to engage in mutual combat can be implicit. It doesn't have to be explicit. In other words, no words need necessarily be exchanged. The other way people tend to get in trouble is if they pursue an aggressor. So somebody punches them and then dashes away, and they decide, you know what, I'm going to give that guy a piece of his own medicine, and they chase him and punch him back.
Right.
Well, if you do that, you've become the aggressor in a second fight. That first guy was the aggressor in the first fight, but once he ran away, that fight ended. He actually regained his innocence. And if you pursue, now you're the aggressor in a second fight and don't have the legal justification of self-defense.
Maybe you go over to the guest station pump next to yours and tell the kids to turn down their loud music.
Yeah.
Anyone would ever do that.
Yeah, that didn't work out so well for Michael Dunn.
No, it didn't. So what's the next one? I think we already covered the next one.
So innocence, we just talked about eminence and proportionality. We've talked about avoidance. Of course, there are some states, there are 16 states that are duty to retreat states. You have a legal duty to retreat before you can act in self-defense. And if you fail to take advantage of a safe avenue of retreat before using force in self-defense, you simply lose self-defense as a legal justification as a matter of law. It's like a light switch goes off. It just goes away. But even in stand your ground states, you can still get in trouble for not having taken advantage of a safe avenue of retreat. In most of the stand your ground states, the prosecution is still free to argue that, okay, you didn't have a legal duty to retreat. We can't strip you of self-defense as a matter of law. But we can still argue to the jury that, hey, a reasonable person would have taken that safe avenue of retreat. This guy did not, and therefore his conduct was unreasonable. And reasonableness is the last of the five elements of the law of self-defense.
But and to be clear there, too, and I when I talk about this with some people, they seem to miss out. If you don't have a safe avenue of retreat, you are not required to take something that does not exist in the first place, right?
That's absolutely right. So even states that impose a duty to retreat, even Massachusetts, which does this with the greatest rigor of all 50 states, it has to have been a safe avenue of retreat. You're not required to increase your jeopardy in order to try to retreat. The difficulty, of course, comes because nobody was there when you acted in self-defense. None of the people, I mean, who are judging your conduct were there.
Right.
So whether or not something was or was not a safe avenue of retreat becomes a matter of rhetoric, of narrative storytelling in the courtroom. And you could end up with a really compelling prosecutor and perhaps not a very good storyteller and a criminal defense attorney. And the jury gets convinced that, in fact, you did have a safe avenue of retreat.
I mean, and that comes up on a relatively regular basis, doesn't it?
Well, the truth is, retreat is rarely an issue in most good self-defense claims. Because people like us, good guy acts of self-defense, if we have an option not to fight, we generally take advantage of that option not to fight. Frankly, from my perspective, stand your ground is one of the least important aspects of self-defense law. I'm a huge proponent of it. I think it's a good social policy. I think every state should have it. But in general, good guys will retreat if they have the option, which makes it very easy to get in trouble if you don't retreat when you had the option, because that becomes the expectation that a jury is going to have. Well, if you were really the good guy, you would have chosen the path of not fighting if you had a safe opportunity to do so.
So, okay, let's talk about reasonableness just a little bit more. Can you go into that just in a little bit more detail, what that means?
Sure. So for people like us, people who are into self-defense, who take the training courses and things like that, reasonableness is really where that all comes into play, because the jury is going to be asked to evaluate your conduct from the perspective of what the law calls a reasonable and prudent person. In other words, would a hypothetical reasonable and prudent person have acted in the same way that you did? And you get to customize that reasonable and prudent person for any specialized training you have. So, for example, if you've taken a training course that taught you the Tooler drill, especially if it ran you through the Tooler drill, that would be ideal, and you had to defend yourself in circumstances against someone with a knife who was 18 feet away and the prosecutor is trying to argue they weren't yet an imminent threat, well, you can bring in an expert witness on use of force issues and have them instruct the jury, essentially, on what the Tooler drill is. So then the jury's told, well, we have to evaluate the defendant's conduct, the defendant being you, of course, from the perspective of whether or not a reasonable and prudent person who's been trained in the Tooler drill would have acted that way in self-defense. And that applies to any specialized training that you might have. So this is really where you have an opportunity to end up with a jury that is not completely ignorant of self-defense tactics and issues and concerns, which is what you would normally end up with.
Right.
Because the general public is not trained in those things. You get to transform that from a jury that knows nothing about these issues to a jury that's really well-informed about those issues. And that's all on the basis of reasonableness, that element of reasonableness.
So essentially you get to explain why what you did was reasonable through the filter of your experience based off of the classes you've been to.
Right, your experience and training.
Perfect. We got to go to break again. Right now we're talking with Andrew Bracca from the Law of Self-Defense. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it, but how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it. And that's where Surefire comes in. From the USB rechargeable 300 lumen sidekick to the 500 lumen X300 Ultra or M600 Scout Light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell, "Aziz Light!" ever again. Doesn't matter if you're shining a light at a potential threat or just helping your friends see through their eyelids at the bar. When you need all the lumens for longer, you need Surefire. Are you German?
Well, a quarter on my mother's side.
Fifth Element reference. Really?
I don't know what movie you're talking about.
Really? Oh, wait. You're kidding.
Never without my permission.
Multipass? And Andrew Branca. Andrew, I'm sorry. I'll stop being silly right now.
All right.
Okay. No. One more? No. All right. Jack looked like he was going to say something. So, as far as everything goes, here's a question that someone kind of wanted me to ask, but I'll let you get to it. When we're talking about what's happened in a self-defense incident or it's going to trial, where does the burden of proof lie most of the time?
The burden of proof, it's a slightly complicated issue, but in essence, once you've raised a claim of self-defense and have it accepted in court, so you're going to be permitted to argue self-defense to the jury, at that point, in 49 states, it becomes a responsibility of the prosecution to disprove your claim of self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the best thing, the strongest defensive position we have going for us, legally speaking, is this tremendous threshold that the prosecution has to cross in order to disprove our claim of self-defense. They might convince the jury that it's more likely than not that you didn't act in self-defense, and the jury still has to acquit you if they have a reasonable doubt that you could have been acting in self-defense. Now, I say that's true in 49 states. The one exception is Ohio.
Hey, Ohio.
Yeah. There you go. So in Ohio, even after you've gotten a claim of self-defense into court and can argue to the jury, you also retain the burden of proving self-defense by a preponderance of the evidence, meaning more than 50% of the evidence, which is a hugely more difficult task than is the burden of proof in the 49 other states.
Well, and luckily, most of the incidents we've had recently in Ohio have been pretty clear-cut, which is good for the people involved in them. But it is sort of a weird thing compared to the rest of the country.
And that used to be a very common standard, actually, in most of the states. But over the last several decades, they've all switched to putting the burden on the prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt, except for the state of Ohio.
Huh.
One thing I want to emphasize to people is, frankly, the importance of knowing these rules before they get into the fight. A lot of people have this kind of expectation that, well, if I ever have to defend myself, I'll just do what I have to do, and then I'll get a good attorney, and he'll take care of the legal issues. Unfortunately, we attorneys are not magicians, and if you violated one of the five elements of the law of self-defense, all five of which are required, if any one of them is disproven by a prosecutor, that's the thing for the prosecutor. He has to disprove your claim of self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. He doesn't have to disprove all five elements beyond a reasonable doubt, just one of them, any one of the five. So you can have the four strongest elements ever imagined, ever seen in a courtroom. But if he can disprove any one of them beyond a reasonable doubt, your claim of self-defense goes away completely. And us criminal defense attorneys, we don't have a time machine. We don't get to go back to the scene of the fight and change what you've done wrong. If you give us bad facts, you're going to get a bad defense. I mean, we zealously advocate for our clients. We're happy to do that. But if we have bad facts, it's very difficult to have a good case. And another thing people need to recognize is it's an inherent part of claiming self-defense. Keep in mind what self-defense actually means in terms of being a legal defense. It means you've been charged with a crime, and you're raising the legal defense of self-defense as justification for your conduct. What that means is by raising self-defense, you're admitting to the conduct. You're admitting to the underlying criminal charge. You're saying, yes, I shot that person, but I did so in self-defense. That's my legal justification. So what happens if you're legal justification of self-defense fails? What's left for the court? A confession. Yes, I shot that person.
Right.
It becomes a very easy conviction for the prosecutor.
I'm trying to think about what are... So generally you don't get charged with a crime if you have done everything picture perfect right. There's witnesses and things like that. Most of the time? Or, I mean, how likely is it that you're getting at least something sent past the grand jury?
You're always going to be vulnerable to a criminal charge. I tell people you should always assume you're going to be arrested and charged. Now, often people are not arrested and charged, but that happens not because the authorities could not criminally charge them, could not indict them, could not prosecute them. It happens because the authorities choose to use their discretion not to do that, given the facts before them. Because remember, the prosecutor knows he has to ultimately sell this narrative to a jury. So if he feels he can't do that, he might not proceed with the case. But we can't prepare only for what a prosecutor might do if he's feeling favorably disposed to us. We have to prepare for what he can do if he's not feeling favorably disposed. A lot of these stories you hear about self-defense and the NRA's armed citizen, or you hear about in the papers, people hear about a situation in which someone used a gun in self-defense and ended up not prosecuted, and they assume that means that the facts of that case could not support a prosecution. Often that's not true. Often they could support a prosecution, but the prosecutor's chosen to use his discretion not to bring a case. I would suggest that you don't want to rely on that because you never know when that discretion is going to be made available to you.
So it's almost like since we're preparing for the worst-case scenario by carrying a firearm in the first place, maybe we should prepare for the worst-case legal scenario afterwards just to be prudent?
That's the exact parallel I use in my seminars. We carry a gun because we're not preparing for an aggressor who's going to decide at the last minute, if we only rationalize with him, that they're not going to kill us or not going to rob us or not going to rape us. We're preparing ourselves for the worst-case scenario in that physical fight, that they are going to try to kill or rape us. You have to prepare for exactly the same degree of hostility, of threat, in the legal fight.
So we got a couple minutes left. I want to ask you one more question, then I want to tell people where they can find you at and all that stuff. How important is it, do you think, to have a lawyer picked out beforehand and maybe even have talked to him a little bit?
Well, those are two different questions. If you mean talk to him in order to learn the law of self-defense, I think that's really important. So you know what to do, you know what the rules are, and you don't violate them out of ignorance or misinformation. In terms of, so you have somebody lined up to be your criminal defense?
Sure.
Honestly, I don't think it's that useful. I have people answer my card all the time. They ask me how they can establish a relationship with a lawyer today. Should they give a retainer to a lawyer? I would never accept a retainer from a client for legal services I might never have to deliver. And you don't know when you're going to need a criminal defense attorney for a self-defense case. 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now. And even if I gave you the name of the best criminal defense attorney for self-defense cases in your jurisdiction today, they might not be when you actually needed them 5 or 10 or 15 years down the road. So I always tell people, don't worry too much about having some lawyer's business card in your wallet. Anybody will be able to get you through the arraignment and get you bail if they're going to give you bail.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you have plenty of time to interview a bunch of attorneys and see who you like. The best thing you can do for yourself in terms of picking an attorney is to know enough about the law so you know what questions to ask and what kind of answers to expect. If you walk in there as a blank sheet of paper, not knowing this stuff to a reasonable level, then any criminal defense attorney is going to sound like a genius. And they're not all geniuses.
So if people want to come out to one of your seminars or buy your book, how are they able to do that?
Best way to do that is at our website, www.lawofselfdefense.com. We have our book there. Actually, we have the third edition of the book coming out in about 4 weeks, so we've stopped selling the second edition. But you can pre-order the third edition and get it in about a month. We do seminars all over the country. We're always looking for more instructors who might want to host us for a seminar. We have an instructors program, so instructors can teach this stuff at a law school-like level. Or at least with law school-like knowledge of the subject, instead of merely being stuck with reading statutes to their class, that kind of thing, which is pretty much the norm today in CCW-type classes.
Right.
Online courses, lots of other stuff, but it's all at our website, lawofselfdefense.com.
Well, and to be honest, too, just so everyone knows, that is one of my number one training priorities this year, is to make it through your instructor class that you are putting on. So I really think that this information is stuff that a lot more people need to think about. But hey, Andrew, we're out of time. I appreciate you coming on tonight, man, very much. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, John.
Hey, no worries. Be safe.
Bye-bye.
Next week, I don't know, because, I mean, I did well. I lined up a show in advance.
That was two. I mean,
so
who can argue with progress like that?
I'm getting better. But it will be someone cool, I promise. Or it might be us answering questions. Anyway, make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And hey, guys, thanks so much for the 5-star reviews you're leaving on iTunes. We really appreciate that. Helps us out. If you want to leave more, that'd be cool. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe. See you next week.